And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we're going to talk about the haunting of 20th century America with Bill Burns and Joel Martin, a classic Coast to Coast show. So get ready. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie. Let's bring in our two guests. First of all, William Burns, Bill Burns, New York Times bestselling author, The Day After Roswell. As a matter of fact, it was that book where I first got to know Bill back in 1997. He is the star of the History Channel's UFO Hunters that still plays over and over again. And he's appeared on Good Morning America. He was on Larry King Live, the Howard Stern Show. He's all over the country. He has authored and co-authored a number of books, including two with me, Worker in the Light, Journey to the Light. Here's Bill Burns back on Coast to Coast. Bill, how are you?
I'm good, George. How are you feeling?
I'm doing great. All is well here in St. Louis and going back to L.A. in a couple weeks and back for the holidays. I can't believe how fast this year is just buzzing by, Bill.
It really has sped by. My head is still turning because I still think it's January.
It's too fast. How's Nancy doing?
She's doing very, very well. Magazine's coming out. One of the things I guess we can talk about tonight is in the upcoming issue of UFO Magazine is a really stunning story on Father Malachi Martin and his secret relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency and UFOs.
That'll be great. And also Joel Martin, he's been on the program before, nationally recognized as a paranormal expert, best-selling author since the 70s. Joel's been his own talk show host. And as a TV talk show host, he has won the Cable Ace Award. He's an investigative reporter. He delves into the paranormal and psychic phenomena. Joel is also a network TV consultant on the paranormal and noted author as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Joel, good to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Now, let's talk about the haunting of 20th century America. First of all, Bill, how did you and Joel... You've co-written a number of books together. How'd you collaborate on this one?
Well, basically, one of the things that happened was the manuscript that we'd written for the original Haunting of America back 4 years ago?
Yeah.
That manuscript was very long, and of course, we all share the same editor, right? Bob Gleason at Tor Forge.
That's right.
And Bob simply said, look, you guys, you're covering 350 years, 400 years of North American history. Let's break this up into volumes. And so we basically segmented the volumes. Haunting of America came out a couple of years ago. This year it's Haunting of 20th Century America. And I think probably in 2013 you'll see Haunting of 21st Century America. So we basically broke up one long manuscript into three.
Joel, was this one fun to research?
Yeah, they are. They really are. If you like history, it's an interesting question. There are a couple of things about the subject matter I found kind of, upsetting, but not because of us writing it. But you read about, for example, the Nazis and their interest in the occult, and kind of shook me personally. But it was very, very interesting to research. It really was. I did not know myself how much material there was, just the vague idea. But when you start to read and research how much there is in New Orleans alone about the paranormal and the supernatural, it's just absolutely stunning.
As we get into this, Bill and Joel, too, feel free to jump in, even if I'm talking to the other one of you.
Sure.
Bill, let's talk about the Nazis for a moment. There's no question that Adolf Hitler was obsessed with the occult and the supernatural. How deep did he go into it?
He went into it very deeply. He was a member, an adherent to something called the Abrexa Society, which was kind of a self-empowerment group with roots back hundreds of years. And so that was one stream of Nazi occultism. And of course, the other stream of Nazi occultism actually began in the 19th century with Madame Helena Blavatsky, who was actually talking about Aryanism and the origins of the Aryan race, and that coincided with this book by Litchi Stratton called Vril, and a group of Russian women led by Maria Orsic actually thought that the Vril, which was like the Force, kind of like the Chi, the Force from Star Wars, that was a force that could be tapped into. And they were talking about the history of the Aryan race and said it actually began on the planet Aldebaran. And that got the early Nazi philosophers, the National Socialist philosophers, really excited about the origins of the Aryan race. And they founded the Thule Society, and thus began the Nazis' fascination with UFOs and outer space and the Vrimana from the Indian Vedic texts. And that colored all of the Nazi experiments with various exotic craft and trying to find a time machine called the Bell di Glocka that disappeared mysteriously from Poland in 1945 as the Soviets were invading. So this whole business, they were two separate streams of occultism that formed the kind of spiritual, I use the term very very guardedly, of Nazism.
So while World War II was going on, Hitler and the Nazis were spending a lot of time and a lot of money dabbling in the paranormal and the occult, weren't they?
Yeah, they actually were, exactly what Bill said. They had almost an obsession with it, Rudolf Hess, some of the others around Hitler, particularly with Hitler. It wasn't only that he was interested in it as a subject. He actually was psychic. Now, I say that very, as Bill just said, guardedly, because I don't want people to think that there's something inherently occult or evil about having ESP or psychic ability.
Right,
but there's absolutely no question that he was himself somebody, I hate to say gifted, but somebody who had ESP or psychic ability. Years ago, to make it a long story short, I interviewed John Toland, who was the biographer who wrote about Hitler in an award-winning book, and I asked him, I said, Mr. Toland, can I ask you just one more question? And I was sure he was going to say, you nut, get lost. And I said, he said, sure. And he said, what? And I said, is it true that Hitler was involved or interested in the occult? He said, what? He said, nobody's asked me that, but the truth is Hitler himself was psychic. And he had a number of psychic experiences and believed that he was himself supernatural. So, He, for example, would know exactly where, what door to walk in. He would know where to enter. He would know where to leave. He would know just where to sleep, literally, during World War I when he was a soldier. But just a few feet from where a bomb would strike, and he was saved and the others were killed. Those kind of stories happened over and over and over again.
And well, he fell short, though, Joel. He fell a little short at the end of the war, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did. And no, that's a great point. And probably the reason is I remember asking John Toland that, and a good deal of that might be attributed to the fact that his mental condition was deteriorating very badly, fortunately
for
the Allies. It deteriorated badly, and he was also on a heavy amount of opiates, of various drugs of various kinds. But when he was alert as a young man, unfortunately, he had a good deal of not only interest, but as I say, some ability himself in the subject. Absolutely. And
go ahead.
Some of the others, as Bill Burns just said, were just absolutely obsessed with the subject.
Well, remember how Hitler survived Operation Valkyrie. He basically had a psychic premonition,
yes,
that he was going to be assassinated. And when you consider who the generals were that wanted to assassinate him, someone like Rommel, who basically won North Africa until Montgomery landed, well, that was one. And the other was, you're right, Hitler was not only was Hitler on a lot of drugs, one of the drugs he was on was liquid methamphetamine that was developed by the Germans very early in the 20th century to keep people awake. And there's a long story about how liquid methamphetamine, how one of the doctors who worked on it came to America and became John F. Kennedy's doctor in the 1960s and helped Kennedy in the first debate with Nixon and eventually got him elected.
Didn't Jean Dixon tell Kennedy, be careful? You know, watch out for Dallas. Didn't she warn him? I think she did.
Yeah, in 1956, or actually earlier than that, even, she had she had predicted that whoever would be elected in 1960 would be assassinated. She never gave more details than that. It was published in 1956 in Parade magazine, the Sunday supplement that still runs in hundreds of newspapers. And she, among others, did warn him about the idea of being assassinated in Dallas. And yes, she absolutely did, at least the story she told me to, and years ago. And George, the fact is that other people had also given him those warnings. And he was somewhat of a fatalist, I guess you have to argue, because he had a sense himself that something could happen or might happen. And he just said, you know, what's meant to be. And it was pretty much like Abraham Lincoln.
Well, Joel, you and Bill wrote a book, The Haunting of the White House.
Right,
and
The Haunting of the President, right.
I remember you told me the story of Lincoln.
Right.
And did he not dream of his own death?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He had, just a matter of a couple of weeks before the assassination, a very vivid dream, and he was wandering through the White House and hearing tremendous amounts of sobs and see soldiers standing around and the people are crying and crying. He can't exactly see who it is that died, but he goes up to a soldier and says, what's going on? What happened? Somebody must have died. What's the sobbing? And the soldier says to him very sternly in the vivid dream, but don't you know the president has been killed? The president has been assassinated? And with that, he woke up, totally startled, and in the morning told his wife Mary about it. And they kind of knew what the fates held in store. Mrs. Grant, too. General Grant's wife, Julia Grant, had a very strong premonition not to go to Ford's Theater that night of the assassination, because she felt also something terrible was going to happen. So premonitions are quite common among a lot of the famous people and the leaders, particularly in this country and probably others.
Bill, go ahead, Bill.
No, especially those people who suffer from various kinds of psychological illnesses. Lincoln was bipolar. Mary Todd Lincoln was clinically depressed. And so during these bouts of ups and downs, they would basically succumb to a lot of these negative premonitions. Kennedy was bipolar because he was on liquid methamphetamines during a long part of his presidency. He was injected by this doctor called Dr. Feelgood, Max Jacobson, and Kennedy had tremendous lows and tremendous highs. So it's just fascinating. And Gene Dixon, as Joel talked about in Haunting of the President, Jean Dixon not only predicted Kennedy's assassination, but she walked into Franklin Delano Roosevelt's office in the White House and basically told him to his face he would not live more than a couple of months. And that was a young Jean Dixon.
That's right. That's at the end of 1944, Bill's exactly correct. And she was also the psychic / astrologer who Richard Nixon, believe it or not, called for when he was trying to wrestle with what to do in the Watergate crisis. So she had quite a history with the presidents. But more fascinating even than that, I think, is the very fact that the presidents were so interested in her, and that there's so many leaders that we have never been taught about really were themselves very, 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 very interested in the paranormal, and for understandable reasons. You're the leader of a country, and when you're in trouble, and every generation is, you're going to take help from pretty much wherever you can get it.
Well, that's
true. These are Pharaoh's prophets. I mean, this is exactly, there is no difference between a Ronald Reagan consulting the astrologer Joan Quigley to set up his schedule and the times when his plane would fly, and Pharaoh consulting his astrologers and his prophets about what to do with the pyramids and what to do with ruling the country. In fact, Jean Dixon, at the end of her life, was very good friends with Phil Corso, because she had been asked to work for the CIA and went to Corso to ask Corso if she should really start working for the CIA, and Corso advised her against it.
You both dive into the darker side of the paranormal. You look at the occult. In where's the difference here with that and the dark side? Or is it one and the same? Bill?
No, it's not one and the same. As a matter of fact, there has been literally hundreds of years of research, and I'm in the middle of doing some of it right now. And what you find is that you have three distinct categories in the paranormal. And it's a really interesting question. And I really, if people take nothing else away from our discussion, if they'll just understand this, we wrote about a range, an arc of experiences from light to dark, if you will, from good to bad, however you wish to word it. But there were three classifications I've kind of discovered in the paranormal. One are the natural phenomena. For example, you have a dream about a loved one, a very vivid dream, and the dream says, don't drive the car tomorrow on a particular highway. You listen, and sure enough, the road crumbles, you know, that kind of thing. We've all had some experience like that. That's natural. It's nothing we've summoned up. The ESP is a good example. Premonition, as Bill said. Telepathy, etc. There's the second classification that has to do with things that are miracles. That gets into the religious nature of things. Somewhat traveling out of body, perhaps bilocation, the Padre Pio type stories, the blood on the hands, you know, the business of the mystical events, the bodies not decomposing. Then the third and last is exactly what we talk about here, which is at the other end of the arc, and that is, of course, the occult, and that is the part that is evil. And the part that is evil is something that we really can't answer in terms of where it's coming from. In other words, was Hitler born evil? Was it something that he did consciously? Was there something that was within him genetically? Or was there actually an evil figure? Bill mentioned before Father Malachy Martin, who studied possession and exorcism, of course, for such a long time. Is there an entity, a devil? Is there literally something that goes into you? So you've got those three broad categories, and just because something is a supernatural or paranormal doesn't necessarily inherently make it good or bad. It depends on its nature and depends on how it's used. Where it comes from, that's another question.
And remember that it was the Bible, it was the church that really categorized the paranormal as evil, even though the stories in the Bible certainly are paranormal. I mean, you know, the classic line is not to suffer a sorcerer to live, because the pagan religions focused on sorcery and incantations and bringing things into existence. And here you have a group of people traveling across the desert through Sinai, coming in contact with pagan civilizations, and they had to remain insular. And so automatically, the religions of those pagan organizations were evil, and that was carried right through to the church and right through to the present day. Look at the Salem witch trials.
Now, in this particular case, pure evil, do you think a child who is born is generally innocent and then they develop this evilness somehow? Or, as Joel was pointing out, Bill, that maybe there's a genetic quirk. I'm not so sure. I think most kids are pretty good, but then environment, parents, right, something turns them into an evil person. Would you agree with that?
I think so, yes.
I mean, I've studied so many serial killers, and a lot of what we call the evil of a serial killer comes from the way that individual is raised.
Yes.
Literally from the time that kid is developing his first Ericksonian psychological crisis at around 1.5, 2, 3 years old, with a missing parent, no attachment, no touching, no this, no that. A lot of classic stuff. But there are individuals, and there have been studies, one very famous a Wolfgang something study in Philadelphia, where there really was a correlation between kids whose parents were in jail, whose fathers were in jail, who later went to jail, and there really was no determination between whether there was something genetic that's going around or whether that was something environmental, that it was the home itself. And yet there are kids born with something called, they basically have a dysrhythmia in the frontal part of their cortex, of the cortices, and they're basically hardwired to be deviant. And whether that becomes evil or whether that becomes simply something and has to be dealt with psychologically and neurologically is something else.
We're talking with Bill Burns and Joel Martin, their latest book, The Haunting of 20th Century America, and also one of the websites, UFOMag.com, as Bill and his wife Nancy are the publishers of UFO Magazine. We're going to come back with both of them and continue talking. Plus, Bill, I'm very interested in the Malachi Martin story. We'll get more of that. We're going to talk about Edgar Cayce, more about the unusual things, the supernatural things that occur. What about the connection with Hurricane Katrina as well? We're going to get all that for you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment with Bill Burns and Joel Martin right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for you Coast Insiders, members of the club, our special chat will be Tuesday night. That's right, this week, Tuesday night. Lauren Coleman, cryptozoologist, joins us. Start time is 1 hour earlier, 7 p.m. Pacific time. So make sure you're part of that. And we'll be back in a moment with Bill Burns and Joel Martin as we talk about their latest work, The Haunting of 20th Century America, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Burns, Joel Martin, why is New Orleans looked at as a history over years as a very haunted city? How come?
Joel, well, talk about Marie Laveau.
Yeah. Bill?
Tell us.
Bill?
Well,
I mean, I have my own opinions, but I just want to say you to go first.
Well, no, I mean, from there was a woman who some called a witch. She was actually well known as a witch, name of Marie Laveau, who put a curse on the entire city of New Orleans because she felt that she was being persecuted. And really, right through modern times, New Orleans has endured so many different crises, Hurricane Katrina being the latest, but New Orleans is a city that supposedly has a curse on it.
Yeah. It is also, of course, the city to which many people came. It was the southern port for a tremendous amount of slave trading, which, if you believe in karma, as I do, is not the best karma to have. And in addition to that, of course, many of the slaves who were brought there were practitioners from Africa, many of the immigrants, who practiced voodoo, people from Haiti. And so when you put together all of the combination of what Bill just described and a couple of things I just mentioned, you've got yourself a very unique place that is rather frightening. Even its cemeteries are kind of eerie if you've been there. Because it's below sea level, of course, you cannot lay the caskets horizontally, and so they call their cemetery Cities of the Dead. And you've got the tombstones literally and the caskets literally vertical. And there's so much about that city that's had such hardship and such tragedy, from the Gulf oil spill through Hurricane Katrina, going back, as I said, to slavery and voodoo, and Madame Laveau, who was of mixed race and apparently just was not treated as well as she thought she should have been. And the curse on that city, whether you believe it, is simply psychological or something that's genuinely some field of energy, has really traumatized that city, I think, in many, many ways. I have been there a couple of times, and frankly, I don't want to hurt the city, but there are some really spooky places and stories in New Orleans.
Well, it's got incredible history. I spent a week there for the Navy, and I mean, it's a wonderful city.
Yes.
Tremendous people, but it does have that eeriness side of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes, it does. Absolutely.
I was down there for an academic conference many, many years ago. Nancy and I went down there, and we were standing on a corner waiting for one of the streetcars. And one of the people from the conference pulled up in his car. He was, I think, one of Nancy's professors from Princeton, literally threw us in the back of his car and said, "You don't stand on this corner at around midnight, because you'll never make it to the conference in the morning." I mean, it was that spooky. We were having dinner at literally the House of the Rising Sun. That was the place we were eating. And as we're sitting there, this was so far below sea level that climbing up the wall, it was something like a gecko. And it's staring at us, and we're staring at it. And it's like you're still eating your food, and this gecko keeps on climbing.
Did anybody ever put a curse on the city?
Yeah, Marie Laveau did put a curse on the city. She was a witch, and she felt that she had been persecuted by the city, and she put a hex, literally a witch's curse, on the entire city. And one of the legends of New Orleans is that that city still exists under that curse. And so when you look at all the things that have happened to that city, the incredible death rate, the incredible crime rate, dodging a bullet with Hurricane Katrina, but yet the dikes still failed. The levees still failed in New Orleans. And then the Gulf oil spill.
Right.
I mean, it's been catastrophe after catastrophe.
One after another.
After catastrophe.
Yeah. Absolutely. And voodoo, of course, goes way back to the 18th century. That's the first time it appears in New Orleans. So this is not a new story, but what Bill said is exactly right. There's nothing I could add to that. It just goes one after the other after the other. And there is, as you said, George, a feeling that that kind of eerie. As wonderful as the cuisine is and the people are and the architecture is, there have been some horrible stories there. And some of it, if you believe again in karma, may go back to even the way black people who were captured mainly from West Africa and brought there were treated so horrendously bad.
Mm-hmm.
So brutally that who knows if it isn't some karmic lesson. But Marie Laveau certainly is worth reading about, absolutely.
Bill, let's take a moment, if we can, to talk about this Malachi Martin story, if you would. To those who do not know the name, he was a Catholic priest, appeared on arts program many, many years ago, several times, and talked about the secrets of Fatima and exorcisms and other issues as well. What have you uncovered, Bill?
Well, this is a really strange story. And it actually started. Now Joel knew, and I think as a follow-up, Joel knew Malachi Martin. They were
yes.
They were friendly. And so to get a personal touch, Joel can talk about the personal side of Malachi Martin. But you're right, he's been on Coast and did some great interviews. But along the way, we were out in Long Island on UFO Hunters in season 3, covering the whole Brookhaven, was there a UFO shot down by a beam coming from Brookhaven in South Park, Long Island. One of the people that I met along the way identified himself as a non-official cover officer for the CIA. And basically, we got to be friendly. He was watching the show being filmed and told me that, you know, some of the secrets of Brookhaven and Stony Brook, and mentioned that his crossing the path, he knew Malachi Martin, and he said his crossing the path of the whole UFO phenomenon had to do with a black bag job that he'd done. This is a story in this issue of the magazine, by the way, because he actually wrote it. I really pressed him to write it. That when he was, let's just say, doing non-official stuff for the government, there were non-government operating organizations, NGOs, that were involved in, let's just say, harvesting UFO material. Okay?
All right.
And he dropped some names. I just rolled my eyes. And he said, these organizations were involved, these entities were involved in harvesting UFO material, sending out people to places like Egypt, South America, but mainly Egypt, to search among the pyramids and places like that to see what they could find and bring this back to them. And one of these people was a college professor who'd gotten a grant from this group. And again, it's a semi-official group. It's not government, but there are government people in it and business
right.
people in it. They sent him out, and he actually found a disc. It's not a disc like a DVD we would send out now, but a version of a DVD, a version of a disc. And he kept it. He wouldn't bring it back and, in fact, was going to sell it to the highest bidder. He knew what it was. And so they contacted this person who spoke to me and said, this is a black bag job. It's a cowboy job. It's something you've got to do right away. So drop whatever you're doing. Get yourself, had to encounter this guy in France, get to this guy in France, get to him before the French Secret Service gets to him, and don't come back unless you bring this object back, which is exactly what he did. That's the story in the magazine. It's exactly what he did. Got the guy, basically renditioned the guy out. And who turns up to collect the disc physically? Who turns up in France? Malachi Martin. Literally. As a member of this committee dealing with the CIA and dealing with this NGO about basic ancient UFO material. And that's the story. And so it blew my mind. So I asked Joel about it, and Joel said to me that Malachi Martin was into some really very, very strange things. Even the fact that his death itself was a really strange death And this one person said to me, why do you think he left the regular orders of the priesthood? He was a Jesuit.
He was a
Jesuit. Why do you think he left that? It wasn't just because he had problems with Vatican II, which basically relaxed a lot of the rules of the Catholic Church, but he was working for our side in doing research in not just into the occult, but in a lot of paranormal stuff as it pertained to the national security of Western European governments. And Joel, you knew Malachi Martin. Tell us about his death.
Well, the death is mysterious, and then I want to second something Bill said, which is so, you know, underline it, because it's really, really not only important, but it's very, very accurate. He either suffered a heart attack or a stroke, or he fell off a ladder and had an accident. And there have been so many different versions of the way he died, or at least several different versions, that you have to wonder what else was going on in addition to natural causes or just slipping off a ladder. That last one always troubled me because he was not in the greatest of health. He had some heart difficulties, and he was already up in years. And I cannot imagine that he would be standing on a ladder in his apartment on the east side of Manhattan, way up high, and then not aware that he could tumble down. He's a little more, a little wiser and more cautious than that.
I would think so.
Talking about Malachi Martin as an individual, he was pleasant to meet. I interviewed him on the phone once, and I know he was on Coast to Coast a number of times. And I did meet him once when I was with a friend. Now, this acquaintance of mine, actually, we were more than acquaintance. He was a good friend of mine in the paranormal. He has since passed on. He introduced me to Malachi Martin, and this is the part I was going to underline, and it really absolutely supports what Bill says. I did not know until sometime later when this friend of mine confided in me that a lot of his paranormal work was also being done with the government. So here, unwittingly, in Manhattan one day, I was being introduced to Father Malachi, then ex-Father Malachi Martin. He wasn't, but he was on leave. That too was confusing, how he got out of the priesthood and why he got out of the priesthood. But here, I was being introduced to Malachi Martin by somebody who I didn't know was also working at the time and doing paranormal research secretly for the government of the United States. So they obviously must have known each other through at least that connection. And so what Bill says has a tremendous amount of truth to it, and you wouldn't know it talking to either one of them, of course. And then I find out later from Bill about Malachi Martin's involvement, and this friend of mine tells me shortly before his untimely passing about what he was able to do. Simply picked up the phone and would call anybody at the top of government because he was that close to the research they were doing secretly.
And he got to them. They would answer. They would get back to him, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Always. Absolutely. I never understood what he was doing. He was a psychic. He was a healer. He was a researcher. It was as if he knew everybody, and I really never understood what means of support he had. And he lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, same area where Malachi Martin lived. Now, for anybody who doesn't know that part of New York, it's pretty expensive. I mean, it always has been. I was raised there, kind of, and it's very costly. Eventually, I couldn't afford to live there, but they did. And I never understood what means of support this friend of mine had. Malachi Martin, of course, became a very successful author, at least, as far as the public was concerned.
Yes.
That was on the record, off the record. What Bill says really bears out from this friend of mine who really knew him and was doing the very same thing.
Was he haunted within?
Literally?
Yeah.
Well, I think if you start to fool around with the occult, I think if you start to fool around with possession or voodoo, there is a psychology. I don't want to get very Carl Jungian. I'm not the world's greatest expert on it. But I do agree that you begin to, if nothing else, pick up the psychology of the evil. And if you start to deal with it.
I just want to reinforce that, Joel, because Malachi Martin helped found this group of exorcists in Connecticut. I think they still function to this day.
Oh, yes.
Dealing with exorcising houses, exorcising individuals.
Right.
And in this one particular case, there was a psychologist. It was a very Faustian moment. This psychologist wanted to understand. She was dealing with people who she believed were evil. They weren't just psychologically dysfunctional or deviant. They were evil. And she wanted to discover the nature of true evil, just like Dr. Faust. And what she did was she put herself literally into a trance. She stared at a pendulum or a swinging object and basically called evil upon herself. And she, according to this group, became possessed. Her whole life fell apart. She was sick. She was doing bizarre things. And it literally took this group to conduct a series of exorcisms on her to bring her back. And I think the most telling story about opening a portal into the world of evil, into the other world of evil, is Joel's story of the Amityville Horror and how something that started out as an absolute financial hoax between Lutz and Weber turned into a series of mysterious deaths, including affecting Joel's own life.
That's right.
You came to some interesting conclusions, Joel, about the Amityville Horror, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, I started out, George. I wasn't even going to bring it up, but since Bill did, it gives me the chills even now. And it's 1974 or so. So it's 35 plus years ago. It was very chilling because I didn't believe it. I was young, and I was naive, and I was interested, frankly, in the ratings. You know, listen, I was on the radio. What was I supposed to do? I had to make a living, and I was trying to be as honest as I could. But I never really thought there was anything to it. And just by nothing more than coincidence, serendipity, I was living closest to where the murders happened of the DeFeos in 1974. I got called to that house as a reporter and for United Press International at the time, even though I was very young. And then after that, I go home that night and my cat dies in my hand. I mean, literally.
Oh.
The night I did the interview with Bill Weber, it was the only broadcast interview he gave because nobody else would let him on. They were afraid to even discuss the thing. My then wife was hit by a car and killed, leaving me to raise a daughter, a small child by myself. And it went on and on that way. Stephen Kaplan, who wrote about the Amityville Horror conspiracy, devoted 20 years to trying to establish it as a hoax. He wrote the book, spent 20 years researching it. 2 weeks before the book came out, 1995, he died of a heart attack. As Bill said, there's so many untimely deaths. The prosecutor on the case died of a heart attack. Several writers, Jay Anson, even the people themselves who moved into the house after the murdered family, the Lutzes, of course, they both died at relatively young ages. And there were many, many others. So what I came to conclude was this, simply put, to make a long story short, I started out believing it was all just bull. And I came to the conclusion that when you start to fool around with evil, it's answering, You're knocking on a door thinking nobody's home, but there's somebody there, and I'm afraid whoever is there answers you, but not quite the way you expect. And too many of the people I know who researched that story and became involved in it saying, oh, this is all bunk, this is silly, this is just a ghost story, ha, 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 got hurt badly because they were unwittingly stepping into something that was evil, not even knowing it. And so it's a story that troubled me. So my position changed 180 degrees. Absolutely.
Now, remember, we talked about this, George, in Worker in the Light.
That's right.
We talked about this in one of the early chapters where individuals we knew, and of course you had your own experience, and that's in Worker in the Light, mm-hmm. that people who delve in negative, dark thoughts, they come back to haunt them.
By 5 or 10 times.
Yes.
And you can't get away from it.
You
really can't.
That's why you're right. That's why it's so bad when you start to fool around with those things, especially those people who over the course of the years have said to me, this is all nonsense. It's all superstition. And I'm not one to proselytize, and I'm not trying to convert anybody. And I always say to myself, don't say that, pal, because you know what's going to happen? It's going to come back at you, and you're not going to believe it. And I don't want to say that to anybody and wish anything that's evil, but, it's like the Jane Mansfield story. She joins the Church of Satan, the Anton LaVey group, and then a short time later is decapitated in a terrible car
accident. Yeah, you're right. Joel, we're going to be back with you and Bill Burns in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we continue talking about the haunting of 20th Century America.